And 7 minutes past 1 o'clock, it is today's Topical Current. Joseph Cooper with you, along with Bonnie Byrne, our Thursday edition. Bonnie, when you were a student at Barnard, did you take any philosophy courses?
I did.
I struggled through an aesthetics class. That's about as far as I got.
I just wanted to say my regrets about the Cardinals.
Oh, well, we were going to get to that when Linda comes aboard because she's from New England.
Okay.
Well, this hour we begin with philosopher, theologian, and author Thomas Cathcart. We'll discuss the ethical questions posed by the conundrum of the out-of-control trolley. Should one human be able to decide who lives and who dies? Thomas Cathcart has written The Trolley Problem, Would You Throw the Fat Guy Off the Bridge? And he joins us from New York City. Hello.
Hello, Joe. How are you?
Good. How are you? Bonnie's with me here, too.
Hi.
Hi, Bonnie.
Hi, how are
you?
How are you? Good. I just want to say for a little book, there's a lot in this, and I found it a lot of fun and very intellectually engaging.
Oh, good. Good.
So why don't we start by explaining both cases before us. We have the trolley incident or the trolley problem, and where a woman let a person die, and the problem of throwing the man off the bridge, the problem of killing a person. Tell us about them.
Yeah. Okay, well, the first scenario was actually dreamed up back in the 1960s by a British philosopher named Philippa Foot. And actually, this is a variation that was dreamed up a couple decades later by another woman philosopher, actually Judith Jarvis Thompson. And what she said was, there's a trolley barreling out of control down the track, and you're standing on the ground, and you see it coming, and you see that it's going to, if something isn't done to stop it, it's going to hit five people and kill them. And for some reason, they can't get off the track. In some versions, they're tied to the track. In other versions, there are high walls on either side of the track. But in any case, they can't get off the track. So you're going, oh my God, what am I going to do? And then you notice that you're standing next to a switch. And if you pull the switch, you see that you're going to divert the trolley onto a sidetrack, so it'll miss the five people. Unfortunately, there's a man on the sidetrack, and he can't get off either. So the question is, would you pull the switch?
Okay. And the second scenario.
Okay. Most people, by the way, say yes, they would pull the switch. You know, better to kill one person than to kill five.
Right, as the woman did in the case that's posited in the book.
Yeah, right. Yeah. The book takes place in a courtroom.
Right.
She did pull the switch. She killed the one. She let the one person die, but she saved the five. Okay, second scenario is now you're standing on a footbridge, and you see the out-of-control trolley coming toward you. You see that it's going to wipe out the five people. They can't get off the track. There isn't any siding. There isn't any switch. But you think, boy, if I drop something heavy enough off this bridge into the path of the trolley, I could stop the trolley before it hit the five people. So you look around on the bridge for something heavy enough that would stop the trolley. You don't see anything except for the fact that there's a very large man standing next to you. So now the question is, would you push the man into the path of the trolley?
Now, most people say no to that, I suppose.
Right.
Most people do, yeah.
Even though you're effectively doing the same thing.
Yeah, in a sense, you are kind of doing the same thing. But people come up with reasons why they're different. That's where it gets kind of interesting.
So, well, I have so many questions, but this philosophy of ethical in intuitionism, or just a gut feeling that we can't even necessarily put into words, a lot of people said they couldn't explain why it was worse to push the man off than it was to just push the switch, right?
Right, yeah. Most people just say, gosh, it just feels different. I don't know exactly why.
Tom, what would happen if the person threw the switch or pushed the fat guy, and then it turns out that the five people who were saved had just robbed a bank and had shot a shot a cashier?
Yeah. And that's why some people say, well, even in the case of the switch, I wouldn't do it, because it's playing God.
Right.
You know, it assumes that you know what the better outcome is. and you're willing to let a man die because you're so sure what the better outcome is.
If you'd like to comment or have a question.
I'm sure our listeners have some views on this.
Yes. You're welcome to join us at 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576. Or you can join us online at our radio at WLRN.org, rather. Radio, email, WLRN.org. So why don't we talk about the doctrine of the double effect of St. Thomas Aquinas from the 13th century.
That sounds like a very exciting prospect.
Actually, well, it is exciting, actually.
It is. Yeah, it really is. St. Thomas dreamed this up in the 1200s, but some people say that's what makes the difference between the two scenarios. Thomas said that sometimes an action has a good consequence and a bad consequence, and it's okay to do that action if the good outweighs the bad, and if certain other criteria are met. And the most important of those is that you can't intend for the bad consequence to happen. You can't use the bad consequence to cause the good consequence. So, for example, in the switch, of course, there were no trolleys around in the 1200s, but if there had been, St. Thomas might have said something like this. In the switch case, you don't intend that that person on the siding be killed. You know, you're not using his death to save the five. It's a bad consequence of the good action, saving the five, but you don't really need the person to die, and you're probably hoping against hope that somehow this guy gets off the track. In the footbridge scenario, you need the guy to get hit. If he doesn't get hit, you're not going to save the five, and so you have to intend his death, and you have to use his death in order to save the five, and St. Thomas says, no, that's not okay. So, yes, so some people say that's the difference, and that's why I would act differently in the two cases.
Tell me more about the role of analogy in the trolley trial.
Yeah. Well, of course, you know, by posing the two scenarios, what you're saying is the footbridge scenario analogous to the switch scenario? You know, because you would sacrifice one to save five in the switch scenario, is that essentially the same thing? Is that analogous to the footbridge case? So in the footbridge case, you know, you're saying, well, sacrifice one, save five. If that's the key principle here, then maybe they are just the same. Maybe I should push the fat guy off the bridge. So analogies, you know, always compare two things that are kind of alike and kind of different. If they were exactly alike, it wouldn't be an analogy. And if they were totally different, it wouldn't be an analogy. So what you're saying is that two things are sort of alike, but they're enough alike that we can use how we would behave in the one instance to say how we should behave in the other instance. And analogies, for that reason, are very powerful, also very dangerous, because really what you're doing is taking two things that are not totally alike, but saying, well, for all intents and purposes, we're going to treat them as if they were alike. And so some people are moved by that in the footbridge scenario and say, well, I guess it is analogous, so maybe I should push the foot.
I was always amused and kind of bewildered by the term that people often use, which is same difference. Now, if something is the same, how can they be different?
Yeah, good question. I'm not sure that expression really makes much sense.
When it comes to the analogies, though, if you use the analogies, you're not using emotions, and you have that MRI study that showed that we're hardwired to be emotional.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, everybody's now jumped on board. This trolley problem, you know, nobody paid attention to it for several decades except a few philosophy nerds, and then all of a sudden it went viral on YouTube. And everybody now is in the game, the psychologists, the brain scientists. And you're right, apparently functional MRI studies of the brain while people are making these decisions show that in the case of the footbridge, they have the parts of the brain that are most associated with emotion light up when you're considering what to do about that scenario. Mm-hmm.
Michael Sandel of Harvard has a similar ethical thing, dealing with a terrorist who's planted a bomb and how to get him to talk and tell people the authorities where it is.
So the emotional parts light up.
So the emotional parts light up more in the footbridge scenario, and the parts of the brain that are associated with cognition are more likely to light up in the switch scenario. So in the switch scenario, you say, okay, 5 is more than 1, 1 is less than 5. You know, it's a very cognitive kind of thing. In the footbridge scenario, what these brain scientists say is that you're so emotionally involved in the actual brute force of throwing somebody off the bridge that you're more likely to act emotionally. And the psychologists come in and say, yeah, and when you're making decisions, P.S., emotion usually trumps reason. But then the philosophers come back in and they say, well, usually trumps, but we always have that decision-making authority. You know, we can decide whether to be led by our emotions or not, or at least to a certain extent we can, or at least we'd like to think we can. And so the philosophical decision doesn't just come down to saying, well, which way am I more likely to react? You still have to make an ethical decision.
We're speaking with Thomas Cathcart. He's a philosopher, theologian, and author. And his latest book is The Trolley Problem, or Would You Throw the Fat Guy Off the Bridge? A Philosophical Conundrum. We're going to take a short break. We'll come back and take your calls and your emails.
We're back. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. Bonnie, we move along from a reference to toilet humor to the trolley problem with philosopher Thomas Cathcart. The switch thrower, Tom, guilty of voluntary manslaughter?
Well, that's a good question, and that's the question that's kind of posed by this courtroom scene. And every reader has to decide for himself. The readers are the jury, so I'm not going to express an opinion.
I have a question, though. Why, about that, why wasn't it called involuntary manslaughter? Because she didn't intend to kill the man on the siding. That was an unintended consequence of her throwing the switch.
Yeah, that's a good question, and one I wrestled with, actually, when I was writing the book. I decided for the voluntary manslaughter because the case that the prosecutor makes is that she made a conscious decision that eventuated in this guy's death. It also makes it more analogous to the guy on the footbridge pushing the fat man off.
Okay.
So, but you've asked a good question. Yeah, I think really legally you might be right that probably if she was charged with it, actually she probably wouldn't in real life be charged with anything.
Well, but that's beside the point.
Yeah, right, exactly.
You have an emailer?
We do. Mary once says, the reason, and this speaks to the altruist dilemma, the reason I could not push the fat guy off is because the only ethical thing to do is jump in front of the train myself if I am to protect the people below.
Oh, that's very good. Yeah, uh-huh. Some people do say that. Actually, the reason that it's specified that this guy is very large is to take that option off the table so that you don't weigh enough to stop the trolley. Only this guy standing next to you weighs enough to stop the trolley.
Right.
But that's another interesting question is if you were large enough to stop the trolley, would you jump in front? Now, here's an interesting thing, too. Some people say, well, because I wouldn't, therefore, I shouldn't push the other guy. Or even in the switch scenario, if, say, you're tied to the track, and by extending your foot, you can reach the switch and make the trolley run over you instead of over the five. So some people say, well, because I wouldn't do that, then I shouldn't do it if it's somebody else on the track. Some people reason the other way and say, well, because I would do it if it were someone else on the track, therefore, I probably should do it if it were me who was going to get run over. So this is, you know, one of the interesting things we were just saying a minute ago about analogy. You know, analogies cut both ways. So, you know, some people say, well, if A, then B. But some people say, well, if B, then A. Mm-hmm. But that's a very interesting observation your emailer has posed.
Mary.
Let's take a couple of calls. First, we have Fred. He's in Boca Raton. Hey, Fred. Go ahead, Fred. You're up.
And, Fred, you need to turn your radio down.
I don't think he's there. Fred. Go ahead.
You need to turn your radio down.
Oh, yes. It's off now.
Okay. Go ahead.
I wanted to respond to to the difficult question and indicate first that you're going to have to be pretty decisive, because you probably got less than a half a second or a second or two, or you're going to lose it all. And the simple fact is that I would immediately empathize myself with the situation, and if I could sacrifice my life for five, I'd sacrifice my life for five. And I hope the woman gets out of the way, because that's where the train's going. And this, the switch is, by the way, mechanically instructive. We trust switches. We don't trust people to run out of the way, and we don't trust ourselves to get there fast enough to save the lady. We're empathizing.
Yeah, very, very good point. Yeah, that's why, you know, it makes a sort of a more of a philosophical issue than it does a real one, because of all those things that you mentioned that would get in the way in real life.
Is he still there?
I have to congratulate you, by the way, on your altruism. You know, well, many people do say they would do that, and many people, of course, say they could not do that or would not do it.
Would you, Bonnie?
I don't know. That's the most honest thing I can say.
I don't think I would.
You don't?
No.
I'd like to think I would, and I'd like to think I could, but in reality, I don't know. Because then that's the altruist dilemma. So I want to talk about the other scenario of the doctor who harvested the one life to save the five.
Yeah, this is kind of a more gross example of the footbridge scenario. This time you're a physician, surgeon, that's been called into the emergency room, and there's been a big pileup out on the interstate, and six patients have been brought to your hospital. And your job is to triage them. And so you triage patient one, and you discover that he needs a kidney transplant. And you look at patient number two, and he needs a kidney transplant. Patient three turns out to need a heart transplant. And number four needs a lung. And number five needs a liver. So talk about unrealistic scenarios. But in any case, here it is. So you're wrestling with this and thinking, oh, my gosh, how am I ever going to find five donors for these five organs? When all of a sudden you take a look at patient number six, and he's been sent in for observation. He's a 35-year-old healthy male, and he's totally okay. There's nothing wrong with him. And so now the question is, now do you take this guy to the operating room, harvest all of his organs, and transplant them into the other five patients? And, of course, people, when they hear this one, go, oh, my God, no, no way. That's totally unacceptable. But then they have to answer the question, well, why did you not react that way in the case of the switch scenario? What's the difference?
Let's move along to another caller. This is Lorenzo in Miami.
Hi, guys. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I had actually more of a comment that would be used as food for thought. So I was thinking about it, and I realized, what if you were to commit suicide before you had to make any of the decisions? So if you committed suicide and then you let the train run its course, the only murder you'd be committing is your own, and that's the only one that you would find yourself responsible for. And, you know, I'm just curious to see what your take on that perspective would be.
Oh, okay, well, like most people with a philosophical bent, I'll answer your question with a question. would you feel yourself responsible for having killed the five if you just let history take its course? You didn't throw the switch. So now you don't have blood on your hands in any literal sense, but it sounds like you would still feel responsible for having killed the five, and that's why you would commit suicide? Am I tracking?
I mean, that's basically like the moral part of it. But I guess my take on that was that if you were doing, if you made that decision to decide to kill yourself, I guess that's like sort of, to put in a phrase, taking the easy way out.
Or what if you knew you were terminally ill? Would that make you more prone to jump in front of the trolley?
Well, that's another
good
scenario.
One.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good one. Good one. Yeah, actually, in the question that you posed, if you do commit suicide, that still has the outcome of the five people getting hit, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what have you? I don't see how you have made the situation any better for yourself or anybody else by killing yourself first.
I guess I had looked at that as more of like food for thought, or just a different perspective on that, than rather just, you know, forcing yourself to make a decision.
Well, we're glad you called.
That makes sense.
Okay, thanks, Lorenzo.
Thanks for having me.
And we move along to Carlos. He's in Miami. I'm short on time, Carlos.
I just a comment on the surgeon. He said that there are like five individuals that need a heart, lung, and there's another
kidneys.
Kidneys
and liver.
Exactly, and there's another one that is completely healthy. In that case, I guess I would just let leave the one that is completely healthy and the other one's not. The reason being is because we, like humans, you know, we are like red ants on the planet, because we are taking over everything, forest and everything else, if you think of that way. Thank you.
Okay. Any comment, Tom? Mm-hmm.
No, I wasn't actually sure that I followed his last part of his point.
Yeah, I didn't quite.
I didn't either. He was saying that he would leave the man healthy, though.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, Lloyd writes, I first encountered a similar proposal at a church youth conference regarding the bomb shelter, 10 people, provisions for 7, who gets in, who's left out. My group opted to eat, drink less, admit all 10, and pray daily.
I like it. Yeah, good solution.
Okay, so what was I going to ask you now? I was going to ask you, that human evolution, that our brains are genetically programmed to have a stronger emotional aversion to deliberately killing one another in societies that were more likely to survive. So we have a genetic predisposition and a psychological predisposition to find hands-on killing repugnant.
Yeah.
So that's in your book, which was why the people are more prone to say they wouldn't throw the fat man off the bridge than they would pull the switch.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Tom, is there a website associated with the book? Because we have to be going pretty soon.
Okay. You can reach the book itself, of course, on the web. There's a little cartoon, which is kind of cute, on the Amazon website. There's the Professor Mandel lectures. It's called On Justice.
Right.
Michael Sandel.
Right.
And in lecture one, he lays out both trolley scenarios and gets interesting reactions from the kids in the audience.
Well, we've been speaking with Thomas Cathcart. He's a philosopher, theologian, and author. And the name of his latest book is The Trolley Problem, or Would You Throw the Fat Guy Off the Bridge? A Philosophical Conundrum. And he's also written Plato and a Platypus Walk into a Bar. We want to thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you, guys. This has been fun. You have a very smart audience.
Thanks. Okay.
Food and Dining.
See you the next book.
Food and Dining is next.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And it is the Thursday edition of Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, along with co-host Bonnie Berman. And, of course, right next to me is Linda Gastineimer, chef, author, syndicated columnist, the lunch goddess. And as a St. Louis guy, Linda, I have to congratulate your Red Sox on their win.
Because I'm from New England?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I did give you condolences, didn't I?
If you don't hit, you don't win.
As a Yankee fan, I have to not congratulate you on their win.
Thanks all around. Can we get to our food today?
So what's on the menu today here?
Okay, right. So leaping from the ice to the stove, that's quite a feat. Where our guest today did just that. He's Olympic gold medal skater Brian Boitano, and he's a winner on ice, but now he's a winner in the kitchen. What Would Brian Boitano Make is the title of his TV Food Network show and his book. He's here to give us cooking and entertaining tips on this Halloween Eve. By the way, I am dressed for Halloween. I don't see too many other people here. But
yes, you are in black and yellow.
Orange.
Orange, yeah.
You're colorblind.
I'm a little colorblind.
Let's welcome Brian Botano. Brian, hi.
Hey, how are you? I'm dressed like a piece of pizza.
A piece of pizza?
Yeah, I'm gonna go as a slice of pizza tonight today.
All right. I don't know what to say to that.
I guess he's got some mozzarella around there.
Yeah.
Well, we'd love to hear from you, our listeners. Do you have any entertaining questions for Brian Botano? Are you having a Halloween feast? Give us a call. That's 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN. Do we have email today?
Sure, radio@WLRN.org.
Join us. Okay, and also, oh yes, we'd like to welcome our favorite wine guy, Fred Tasker. He's joining us by Skype, and you can read Fred's wine column in today's Miami Herald. Fred, are you dressed for Halloween?
Oh, absolutely. I'm dressed like a lumberjack up here.
Is it cold already, Fred?
Yes, it is. We had 23 the other day, a little snow.
Oh, my. All right. Everyone, Fred's in Michigan.
A longtime Miami guy.
Right.
I'm loving it, too.
Okay. Well, let's go to Brian Botano. Brian, what would Brian Botano make? The title comes from a very unusual source. Tell us about that part of your life.
Well, originally, the title was for the South Park song, What Would Brian Botano Do? So in South Park, they did a song about me in the movie.
Wait a minute, Brian.
Yeah?
Wait, just hold on for 1 second.
Yeah.
What would Brian Boitano do if he was here right now? Yeah. He'd make a plan and he'd follow through. That's what Brian Boitano do.
When Brian Boitano was in the Olympics skating for the gold, he did 2 stout cows and a triple lutz while wearing a blindfold.
When Brian Boitano was in the Alps fighting grizzly bears, he used his magical fire breath and saved the maiden's bear.
We had to cut it off there, Brian, for obvious reasons. It's public radio.
Yeah, exactly.
Thanks, Paul.
Although
Mary.
I did not do 2 sow cows in a triple lutz in the Olympics, I wouldn't have not won the gold medal if I only did that. The movie came out, South Park, and I heard from a bunch of people that there was a song out about me, and I'm like, oh well. So I went to go see the movie, and I was like, oh, they were really nice to me. That's really cool. And I thought it would like sort of go away in a year, it would die down, but as things progress in this day and age, everybody started seeing it and, renting DVDs and all that kind of stuff. And so I just, had to embrace it. And so this was my way of sort of embracing it and, joining in on, all the fun and naming my cooking show first after that and then naming the cookbook after it as well.
Well, it's a wonderful way to start out. So Brian Boitano, your passion for good food comes from your large Italian family and your travels. So how does that work with your sports diet challenge?
That's a really great question. I have a rule, 2 days on, 2 days off. So if I, splurge for 2 days, I'm really good for 2 days. And the way that I eat usually is pretty much a Mediterranean diet. It's very clean eating. I eat a lot of fish. I eat a lot of greens. So when I'm preparing stuff for myself at home or, if one or a couple friends come over, it's a really clean, very simple diet. I don't tend to eat a lot of carbohydrates like when I'm eating at home, although I do love, pastas, but I only do that once in a while. So I'm pretty clean, pretty low-cal. I have a way of not adding flavor but not a lot of fat into my cooking. I like doing, fresh ingredients, easily accessible ingredients, and I just eat pretty clean, and then on other nights, I'll splurge and eat something a little bit more fattening.
Like what?
Bonnie wants to know the fattening part.
Well, not always fattening, but I'm always trying to watch my cholesterol. But the other night I had short ribs because I love short ribs. It's my favorite thing. I love braised meats, but I try to be careful about that. I mean, I try to eat more fish and chicken because I'm trying to watch my cholesterol. And so when I sort of break habit, I literally will have, a steak or, some beef or I love doing this pork shoulder that I braise in pineapple juice. So
and all of these are in your book.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
I suspect, Brian Boitano, that all the skating you do helps with your diet. some of that exercise?
I mean, I do an hour and 45 minutes a day, 4 days a week, and then the other days I go to the gym. So I'm literally working out all the time.
So you said you eat low carbs. Is it true that you need carbs to do that kind of workout?
You know, it's interesting. When I was younger, my entire diet during the Olympics was pretty much based on carbs. I ate low protein and high carbs, and I think it was just the intensity of the workouts and just what I was craving. You know, people crave different things at different points in their life, and for me, I'm not craving the carbs as much, and I love it. I love eating the fresh pastas when I go to Italy, and I love making, you know, pasta and that kind of thing. But for some reason, I sort of listen to my body. My body craves what it needs. And so I haven't been craving carbs a lot. And so that's the only reason that I leave them out of my diet, because I really do believe that moderation is the way to success when you're watching what you're eating.
So Brian, let me ask, sorry, go ahead.
Brian, if I might ask, what do you weigh now and how does that compare with when you were in the Olympics?
That's getting personal.
I'm 5'11", and I weigh 175 now. And in the Olympics, I weighed 157.
Oh.
Yeah. So, and you know, and I'm and you know, to look at me, I'm in you know, really good shape, and you know, I work really hard at it. But I had to be so rail thin when I was in my 20s because I was, you know, competing against guys who are a lot smaller than me, so I had a tendency to look much bigger than everybody else on the ice, which I am. I'm pretty big for a skater. I'm, you know, 5'11", and most of the guys that I competed against were like 5'4", 5'3", so I looked like, you know, a big Amazon out there.
That's interesting.
All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about entertaining and all from your book. Your book's about casual entertaining, and what could be more casual than Halloween?
I know.
So what are some fun things we can do for Halloween dinners or food?
Well, I'm really into this, like, entertaining unplugged thing, because I think people are so intimidated when you entertain in the dining room. At least my friends are like, oh, my God, the dining room set up. I'm like, it's relax. It's just a dinner. We're just sitting in the dining room. So now I'm doing this thing where I entertain around the kitchen island, and I'll set up like a cocktail mixology bar on the counter, and everybody will mix their own cocktails, and I'll have like different simple syrups and bitters, homemade bitters and simple syrups. And
I notice you have a very large drink section in the book.
I do. I love
this is the first thing you're talking about.
No, I know, because my friend, you know, it's like such a big thing here in San Francisco, the mixology aspect of it. And friends love doing it. I want everyone to try to set up, like, you know, a mixology station, because it's just so popular with my friends, and everybody gets to experiment. It's like a scientific experiment of what spirit and juice and simple syrup and bitter to mix up, and it's a fun night for your friends, and they make drinks, you taste everybody's drinks, and then you see who's you like and who wins for the night. And I do that same thing with the appetizers. So what can we do
for Halloween?
Halloween, you know what I like doing for Halloween for drinks is I'll do a simple syrup and I'll color it red, and then before you put the cocktail in the glass, you drip it down the side of the glass, and then so it looks like blood dripping down the sides, and then I pour the cocktail in the glass like that. So, and then you could actually rim it in a sugar that's red or black, which is really fun. So
how do you make the sugar red? With food coloring?
No, you can buy red sugar. You can buy it, like, you know, in the store red. I think it's probably food coloring, but yeah, you can buy it in the store red.
Okay.
Do you have any wine or beer in all of this?
I mean, when I have friends over for tastings and stuff.
You're talking about mixed drinks.
Yeah, I mean, I keep the house, you know, I keep beer in the house. I keep ginger beer in the house, which is really popular now. I definitely do wine. But it's not as fun to pour a glass of wine as it is to like sort of experiment with different cocktails and mixing.
Not as creative, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly. But I'm good. I'm doing a Halloween with my niece, my new niece, and one of my best friend's daughters. We're going to go trick or treating. So I'm going to do a whole slew of things for them for dinner tonight.
Well, give us an idea.
Like what?
So I'm going to do my nephew loves my mac and cheese. So I'm going to take those little tiny pumpkins and I'm going to serve the mac and cheese inside those little pumpkins.
Oh, and that's great.
Yeah, isn't that fun?
That's cute, yeah.
Do you cook the pumpkin when you do that?
No, you just leave it raw.
Oh.
You just hollow it out, Fred.
Yeah, you hollow it out. Yeah, exactly.
And you mentioned to me that you could do like a grilled cheese sandwich and with cookie cutters, maybe.
You know what? I'm doing cookie cutters on a grilled cheese sandwich tonight that has like a witch. I found a witch on a broomstick. So I'm going to cut out the cheese sandwiches after I've done them with the cookie cutter and serve like little witch sandwiches. And then I'm serving, I make this molten chocolate cake, and then it's with a raspberry sauce. So I'm going to fill this little plastic syringe with the raspberry sauce so that after the molten chocolate cake comes out, then they can squirt their own syringe of raspberry sauce on the molten chocolate cakes.
You've got a lot of time on your hands.
This all sounds wonderful. Well, I'm Linda Gassenheimer. My guest today is skating Olympic gold medalist and TV cooking star Brian Boitano. We'll take a short break here, and we'll be back with more. And we're back. I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and our guest is skating Olympic gold medalist and TV cooking star Brian Boitano. His Food Network show and his book of the same name is What Would Brian Boitano Make? Fresh and fun recipes for sharing with family and friends. And he's been giving us some wonderful Halloween tips, plus general eating tips. And you can come and meet him. He's going to be at the Miami Book Fair on Saturday, November 23rd. And if you want to see him cook, he's going to be there on Sunday at 1 p.m. at the Miami Culinary Institute. So he looks pretty cute on the book, so I would come if I were you.
Is he going to be skating?
I'll be skating into the kitchen, you think?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, also, I could do it on rollerblades.
There right. you go.
No, I don't think so. My feet would hurt.
Okay.
Also appearing at the book fair is going to be Manuel Villacorta, and he's going to be talking about his book, Peruvian Power Foods, and that's going to be on Saturday, November 23rd at noon. And if the book fair is going to have a lot of wonderful authors. Watch your papers for the full list, or go to Miami Book Fair MiamiBookFair.com for a fairgoer's guide. Okay, so now it's going to be dinner in minutes. So it's Halloween. We're going to have a Halloween stew. It's a haunting stew. It's sausage, beer, and potato. And cooking the ingredients in the beer adds an intriguing depth of flavor. So I take some turkey sausage, and Joe, yes, you can have pork sausage. Take some sausage, and you slice it, and you saute it with some sweet potato cubes, onion, green bell pepper for several minutes. Then I add some apple slices, because of course it's Halloween, some tomatoes cut up into cubes, and the beer. And all you do is cover and simmer it for about 15 minutes.
How much beer?
12 ounces, is that all right?
Well, you put in like a whole can.
A whole can or bottle, right. And then you could save a little bit to drink while you're cooking it. Okay. That's a one-pot meal. By the way, it freezes well, so you can make the complete recipe and double it. And if you want the whole complete recipe and a photo, go to dinnerinminutes.com. You can also follow me on Twitter. That's at L. Gassenheimer. Brian, you must have a Twitter account.
I do. It's at Brian Boitano, and I actually posted the Halloween cocktails on there. And then I'll retweet you today.
Okay, do that. That'll be great. All right, Fred Tasker, what are we going to drink today, Halloween Eve?
Well, Brian has very well covered cocktails for Halloween, so I guess I'll talk about what wines would go with Halloween. And fortunately, there are so many choices, it's downright spooky. Oh.
That's too much, Fred.
Too much. Anyway, first, if you're the kind of parent who filches the Hershey bars from your kid's Halloween booty bag, and probably the kind who chews off the chocolate bunny's ears at Easter as well, shame on you. But you might want to know that milk chocolate goes well with a soft, fruity red wine like Shiraz from Australia. Now, if you live in a more discerning neighborhood and your kid brings home expensive, high-quality bittersweet chocolate, and of course you commandeer that, then the proper match is a big, powerful red port. This is for you, not for the kid, obviously. Other Halloween candies have their own matches. Candy corn, severed witch's finger cookies, peeled grape eyeballs, gummy worms, and such, when eaten by adults, go well with a sweet white dessert wine like sparkling Moscato, which is very popular these days.
I'll have to get my candy corn going here.
Yeah, that's the finest candy, if you ask me. I think that's the most popular candy in America. Anyway, for the kiddies, you can use 7-Up. I mean, with all the sugar candy they have, their teeth are doomed anyway, so you might as well. Now, in my family at Halloween, we have a fond tradition of making what we call a dead man's meatloaf. This is meatloaf made in the shape of a chubby stick man using sliced stuffed olives for eyes and sweet corn for teeth, with a kitchen knife embedded in his chest and a good splatter of ketchup for blood. A great looking concoction. Now, for this, you need a red-blooded wine, and I know just the perfect one. I had this in Hungary one time, and you can buy it in Miami. It's called Egri Bikaver. It's a Hungarian wine that translates as bull's blood, and it got this name in the 13th century when the Ottoman Turks invaded Hungary, and the Hungarians were drinking the Egri Bikaver red wine for courage, and their beards were all stained red from it. So the Turks thought the Hungarians were getting their extra courage from drinking bull's blood. So they fled, and the wine's name was born. This is very nice stuff.
And you can buy it here?
Yeah, I would try Total Wine and More, or call any large wine shop. They should probably have it.
Okay.
Finally, if you're a beer drinker, don't despair. Lots of breweries, including Sam Adams and Dogfish Head and such, make pumpkin ales that sell from now through Christmas. They have pumpkin pie spices, and they really taste pretty good. They're great with hearty stews, pumpkin cheesecake and such, or with Linda's sausage and beer stew. That would be just perfect.
Okay.
Although I don't think I would have the beers with the candy.
All right. Thank you, Fred Tasker. Brian Botano, let's go back to talk about, you talked about entertaining in your book, and casual entertaining, and you mentioned, you know, people get upset with if they see a set table, they just want to. Yeah. You have people helping out in the kitchen, which everybody congregates there anyway, so they may as well help. But yeah. How do you organize that? How do you get everybody to pitch in without total chaos in the kitchen?
Everybody comes over and they all say, "What can I do?" And what they mean is, what can I do that's really, really, really simple? They don't really want to do anything difficult. So I'll have everything prepared in little mise en place bowls, so that if we're eating a bean salad that night, that I'll just have all the different ingredients and say, hey, you can mix all those ingredients in the salad, and then if you could dress it. Or if I'm doing appetizers and I'm doing like little, I do these little sopapillas, which are little fried dough pillows that I stuff the bean salsa into it. So I'll have them all prepared to fry up, and I'll heat the oil, and I'll just have them, you know, give them an apron so nothing splashes on them, and have them fry up the dough puffs. So something
you have ex- that, go ahead,
do you
Fred.
Ever find that your amateur helpers mess up your finely wrought recipes?
You know what? And then that's fine. I really don't believe that there's any mistake that you can make if you add a little bit more of an ingredient or not. I mean, you can oversalt something or burn something, but you know what? I'm in the kitchen with them. We're all standing together. So I see what they're doing, and they always ask me, but I think the key is to just keep it simple and let people help you prepare. If you have three appetizers on the menu for that night, let them mix something or just chop this parsley and then sprinkle it over the top. Keep it simple, have things prepared before they get there. And then the finishing touches can be done by them, and then they feel like they're contributing, and you eat as you go, and you drink as you go.
All right.
Good way to break the ice, if nothing else.
Well, we only have about 30 seconds left. Quickly, what are you going to be cooking here at the book fair?
What I'm going to be doing, I'm going to be doing my pork shoulder that's braised in pineapple juice. And I am doing a bourbon bacon apple tart, which is
I saw
like,
that in the book. I couldn't get over drooling.
You wouldn't believe how you got to come and taste it. And it's topped with a candied bacon, and I have to make like three times the amount of bacon because all my friends go eat the candied bacon before I can incorporate it into the dish.
Wow, that sounds too decadent. Sounds wonderful.
Yeah,
you'll have to do a lot of skating after that, huh?
I'm not going to eat it. I'm going to serve it to everybody else.
All right. That sounds great. Well, it's been a really very, very tasty week. Brian Boitano, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I will be looking forward to seeing you here in Miami at the Book Fair.
What's going on next week on this program?
I'm going to tell you.
Okay.
So next week, we'll be looking behind the scenes at Joan Stonecrab.
Ooh.
Whoa. Author Dini Kaplan-Lorber. Her book is called Waiting at Joe's, and it's a double entendre here. It's not just waiting.
How about those grilled tomatoes that they have there?
Well, I thought you were going to talk about stone crabs.
Well, definitely we want those. I hope she's coming with crabs.
Well, we'll see. You get a little spoiled here, Joe. You get lunch every week, you know. Anyway, I'd like to wish everybody a happy Halloween. And I'm Linda Gassenheimer. Join me next week.
Happy Halloween.
And thanks for tuning in. Our producer is Richard Ive. Technical direction from online producer Paul Leary. Also thanks to Lorenzo Ponce de Leon. We have free audio archives and downloads of this and previous programs at our website. That's WLRN.org. And more information, book links, discussion, and such at the Topical Currents Facebook page with Twitter links. Tomorrow at 1, it's Ed Bell and the South Florida Arts Beat. You don't want to miss this. A great live concert in store from the renowned Iko Iko Blues Band. Bonnie and I return Monday. And to the calendar, on this day in 1864, 149 years ago, Nevada is granted statehood. Though its population was too low to meet legal requirements, good old Abe Lincoln pushed the action through Congress to gain 3 electoral votes for his re-election. And on this day in 1950, 63 years ago, the birth of comedian John Candy in Newmarket, Ontario. He began with SCTV and is probably best remembered for Uncle Buck. He died of a heart attack at age 43. And one more while we remember the good war and hard times. On this day in 2008, 5 years ago, the death of historian, broadcaster, and journalist Studs Terkel in his beloved Chicago. He was aged 96. Today's recipe at dinnerinminutes.com. We leave with a thought from Studs Terkel, quote, "Chicago is not the most corrupt American city. It's just the most theatrically corrupt." Maybe. This is Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman, Linda Gassenheimer, Fred Tasker. Stay with Public Radio. Here and Now, up next from NPR News.